is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Laura Foote Clark. She runs the organization Grow SF. Laura, it's great having you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
And I'm also joined here with Rabbit.
Yeah, it's great to be back.
Laura, can you tell us about your organization and what got you interested in starting it?
Yeah, so Grow SF, Grow San Francisco, was started by me and my friend Austin Hunter, and then we were joined by another girl, Annie Fryman, and we're all kind of millennials who were really frustrated with the state of housing. My friend Austin had been working on campaigns which pay extremely poorly, although he loves it, and was, you know, really struggling, you know, commuting long distances to get into the city. He was living in the outer Richmond. You know, I was in kind of a, you know, one of the tech jobs that nobody talks about, sales, one of the sort of underpaid jobs that kind of suck in tech. And Annie Fryman was working for a small architecture firm, and was really seeing firsthand all of the difficulties that go into getting new housing on the market. So I think all of us were really frustrated with it and wanted to start an organization that was going to start talking about housing, not from the developer's perspective, but from what we see as the user's perspective, right? People who live in housing. And so wanted another organization that was going to advocate for more housing in the Bay Area.
Is the San Francisco Bay Area, is it the most expensive region in the country? I read it's even, I think it even surpassed New York.
Yeah, and the other thing about comparing us to New York is that, and I've lived in New York, so I grew up in D.C., I've lived in New York, Chicago, and San Francisco. The integrated transportation of New York, the five boroughs, takes some degree of the pressure off. You know, if you get displaced out a little bit further in New York, because of how great the public transportation infrastructure is, it's less painful. In San Francisco, because we're so artificially politically small, you know, it's like West Manhattan was running its own government and didn't integrate public transportation with the rest of New York. I think it's a pretty good metaphor. You know, when you get displaced in San Francisco, you know, you, most of the time you're moving to another city. You're just sort of not able to make a go of it. If you don't own a car in San Francisco and you're getting pushed out, you know, where are you going? Are you going out to, like, furthest reaches Oakland and sort of the suburbs beyond that?
Or even, you know, I've heard of people commuting as far as the Central Valley.
Yeah, I mean, it's nuts. And so the San Francisco that we talk about is really, we should be thinking and talking about San Francisco metropolitan area.
Well, it's interesting as I was thinking about this. So I'm from LA, and in LA there's a lot of opportunities to increase housing. If you look at a lot of these, like, parking lots and strip malls, you could turn a lot of them into high rises as long as there's access to transit. And I was kind of under the perception that San Francisco has a very limited potential to build new housing without, like, destroying historic architecture. But I was looking at your Twitter feed, and you were posting these pictures titled, like, Waste of Space. Can you talk about that? And have you thought about putting it into something, like organizing it and putting out, like, a map of, like, all those different parking lots that you pointed out?
Yeah, I mean, I would love to, you know, I don't have a lot of free time, so it's mostly when I really get angry going around the city taking pictures of parking lots. But my favorite that I love to scream at is on Market Street, sort of just north of the Castro at, like, Church and Market. There's a giant Safeway that's built like it's out in the middle of nowhere, surrounded by this ocean of parking. And I listen to people all the time who are like, oh, the Bay Area is full, you know, we're like at capacity. And I'm like, at capacity? Like, that's just nuts. There's so many empty lots all over this city. And there are vast areas of the city, like, in addition to the pure empty lots, There are vast areas of the west side of the city that are zoned single-family home only, which means that they cannot be subdivided. So even though you might leave the building intact, you can't say, okay, now we're going to make this into a two-family household instead of a one-family household. It's easier to put an addition onto a house than it is to add another unit. And I just think that that's the kind of political structure that we have made adding housing to the Bay Area really hard. And we've done it on purpose. I mean, there were people who made this network of bad housing policy on purpose with the goal to limit the amount of housing.
I know there's been a lot of these major sort of these mega developments. Like one of them I can think of is Mission Bay, but that was, I mean, a lot of it looks like I've seen pictures, it looks like a suburban office park. That was kind of a wasted potential.
Yeah, I mean, we've spent a lot of energy on what are considered mega developments, and they get a lot of press and branding because we make housing really difficult, so they have to sort of go on this PR offensive to, like, you know, win over every voter in order to just pass a regular old big housing construction project. You know, because every voter pretty much, you know, has the ability to say, oh, we need you to do another study. We are going to put you for discretionary review. You know, there are a lot of things that people can do to slow down projects.
What are your thoughts on some of the future proposed mega developments? I can think of a couple. I know there was the one that you wrote about in Brisbane, which was downsized. But there's also some ones, I think there was one planned on a military base or a naval base on Alameda Island, but that was like downsized to single family homes. And then there's one like a Brooklyn Yards in Oakland, which I think is fairly high density. And there's also plans for like the military bases in the suburb cities of like both Concord and Dublin.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of these projects that are great. So, you know, a lot of them get downscaled through the entitlement process. But I think more fundamentally, we need to stop thinking on a project-by-project basis. You know, an individual project takes place in a specific geographic area. And so the people who are going to feel the negative effect of that project, you know, are very easily activated. The negative effects are felt acutely by a small group of people, right? But the general good is felt by a diffuse population of all of us, right? We all feel the benefits of increasing the general housing stock. And so if we continue to fight this battle on project-to-project basis, I think we're going to often lose because, you know, those people who feel the negative effects are very, you know, they show up to every fucking hearing. The general good needs to be at a larger level. We need to make rules and then follow them. The permitting process needs to have more sort of general rules and streamlined. You know, we need to make bigger picture zoning decisions rather than having all of these projects we fight with a nail over.
What are your thoughts on the recent zoning changes in the South of Market District? I think it was like the Central SoMa zoning plans.
Yeah, I think it's good. You know, it's a step in the right direction. I think we're going to need much bigger things. I think that it was probably pretty low-hanging fruit. You know, Central SoMa, you know, is not considered, quote, one of the neighborhoods. You know, getting housing out on the west side is where we're really going to see people freak out. I don't know if you guys are paying attention to the Affordable Housing Density Bonus Program. Do you hear people know about that much?
Are you talking about the governor or Jerry Brown's plan?
No, that's by right. So this was the local proposal to say projects that do additional affordable housing can go an extra two stories higher and have more units on them, and especially focused along transit corridors. So pretty modest proposal that would seemingly be something that would please everyone. It's more affordable housing and it's more housing in general, and that was focused on transit corridors. And the response by people on the website was like, I mean, it was a little bit crazy. They printed out a map of where the new law was going to apply, and then they put a like target over top of it as if we were dropping bombs on the neighborhood, and they were like, whose neighborhood will be next? And it was, like, completely overblown. No one was listening to what the proposal actually was. You know, West Side people don't want more housing in their neighborhood in general. I mean, there are more and more renters out there, and that's hopefully where we can sort of start to turn the tide. But there's, you know, that they, there are a lot of people who kind of want to be living in the suburbs out there, and they don't really want to feel like they live in the city.
Is this Krishan?
Yeah, this is me.
Hi. Cool. Nice having you on the show. Do you want to ask a question?
Was the lower foot clock over there yet? Or I just called
she's
in.
On.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
She's on. Oh. Okay. I think I'll just listen in right now because I haven't been following the conversation. I'm sorry.
I have a quick question for Laura. Like, what do you think about micro apartments? I know that those are kind of controversial, but in Seattle, they've had some a lot of success there making affordable housing. You know, for you can get a good apartment there for like $600 a month in some parts. You know, that would normally cost like $2,000, $2,500 if you're like a young professional. I don't know, but they're still kind of controversial because you know, on the one hand, they bring more affordable housing for different types of people, but on the other hand, some people oppose them because they're, you know, in a sense, asking people to live in, you know, meager conditions and things like that. So I was just wondering what your opinion is.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really get why they're so controversial. I think there's two things. There's one is there's no more meager condition than being evicted and displaced and pushed out of the city completely. So anything we can do to alleviate that is probably going to be a net good. I also think that, you know, people don't like to sort of compare the actual situation. They compare micro units to like an ideal of like giant apartments, when really the thing that you're comparing it to is people living with, you know, 6 or 10 roommates in a house. You know, micro apartments would probably replace, you know, the housing that most of my friends are living in, that is currently, you know, people say it's anti-family. That's where some of the controversy comes from, which I think is silly because right now what are thought of as family apartments are being taken off the market by people living with multiple roommates. And, you know, we need to create housing for all the different kinds of people who want to live here and who, you know, have jobs here. And, you know, if we're going to deal with the fact that we have this, that we have a fantastic booming economy, we need to build to that. Or else we're just going to see more displacement. I mean, I'm sure I'm preaching to the choir here, but.
Yeah, well, I think it's interesting you bring that up because it's true. Like, when I lived in West Hollywood, you know, there were six of us living in a two-bedroom apartment, and we had, you know, bunk beds in the living room. So it's not like if I would have been living in a micro unit that I would have had, you know, that much more space. If anything, I would be, you know, I would have my own bathroom rather than sharing, you know, the one bathroom with six other people that were, you know, two of them, you know, two a room and then two in the living room living in these bunk beds. And then, you know, you have in San Francisco, I mean, you know, I've known people, you know, they're paid like $700 or $800 a month to live in somebody's, like, walk-in closet. You know,
right.
You know, people actually rent those out. So, you know, when we're comparing it, it's not like, you know, we're comparing it to what is actually available right now. And I think it's pretty much what you said.
Yeah, I think there's this thing, I think someone was talking about the Nirvana fallacy, that I think people fall into a lot here, where they compare this to what would be like a perfect, you know, situation. And that's not, you know, oh, if we don't build housing, then, you know, everything will stay the same, as opposed to, no, if you don't build housing, things are going to change dramatically. You know, instead of sort of playing out the rest of what's actually going to happen, they compare it to, you know, an idealistic idea of what they think might happen.
So are you kind of saying if you build no housing, things will be extremely expensive? If you continue to build, if you build housing, things will still be expensive, just slightly less?
Yeah. I think if we, I mean, we're 30 plus years in the hole, right? We've spent decades chronically underbuilding housing in the Bay Area. So getting out of that hole is going to take a really, really long time. And the best that we can do is start to bend the curve. You know, I mean, that was the big promise of Obamacare was, you know, maybe we're not going to make healthcare extremely affordable right away, but we can start to bend the cost curve. I would say the same applies to housing. No, tomorrow we are not going to have, you know, all the affordable housing. But we can start to bend the cost curve if we build housing, and especially if we build housing throughout the Bay Area, stop allowing our suburbs to, you know, get away with nonsense that they've been getting away with for decades.
And that's the thing is, I mean, San Francisco is always going to be an expensive, desirable city, but there is potential of building large amounts of, like, middle-income housing in cities like, say, Emeryville.
Yeah, and it's always going to be more expensive probably than living in a rural area, but that's because the benefits that come with living in a city mean that your average income and your average potential income, the same person moving to a city, can earn far more. That's why people want to move to cities, is because they're places where you get more resources and you get more opportunities for jobs, you know, even, you know, unskilled. There are better opportunities in cities.
And obviously, I mean, a lot of the jobs are in the Silicon Valley, and the Silicon Valley is an area which most of it is like a single-family homes, but I have seen these sort of proposals. They're more sort of, I don't know how realistic they are. They could be kind of these like fantasy conceptual cities, but I've seen these proposals of building housing around the tech campuses that would accommodate like all the workers. Have you seen those?
Yeah, it's a beautiful fantasy. You know, they're great ideas. You know, there's also a project being proposed near the Millbrae BART station that is going to, you know, potentially add a lot of units right on. It's taking a big parking garage right near the BART station there and can do a mass amount more housing. And it's really controversial there. You know, I don't know if you've been out to Millbrae, but it is, you know, they haven't built very much housing. I mean, I don't want to rag too much on Millbrae, but, you know, it doesn't want to think of itself as a city. And it doesn't want to think of itself as part of a functional Bay Area urban metropolis.
I saw there's this sort of a campaign that you're affiliated with called, like, Sue the Suburbs. Can you talk about that, and what are some of the objectives of that?
Yeah, that's a fun one. So that is Carl, a 501c3, is doing these lawsuits against the suburbs. And it's an effort to, you know, kind of build out a new piece of housing law and say these people are out of compliance. So there was one of the big ones, there was a big project, on Lafayette, going to be like 300, apartments. It got down to about 30 single family homes, because neighbors in the area freaked out about it. And it's so, you know, everyone's like, oh, we're protecting our neighborhood.
Was this specific project over like a parking lot, or was it over like open space?
Space, but it was like a lot. It was parking spaces are open space. Parking lots are considered open space a lot of the time, which is weird. You know, it was in a suburban sprawl area. They don't to think of Lafayette as sprawl. But most of the suburbs around San Francisco, you know, I think objectively are sprawl. And if we're going to have infill development, even things that are sort of empty lots need to be taken seriously, as they aren't preserved green space. They're potential for infill development.
And that's kind of the thing. Like, obviously, I'm sympathetic to a community that would be, that wants to, like, preserve open space. That's completely rational. In a lot of cases, you have people who they would object to just developing, like, a parking lot in their community.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a big parking lot. What's the name of the south? Balboa Park Reservoir is a great example of that. So that's, in the south area of San Francisco, Balboa Park, there is a reservoir which has never had a single drop of water stored in it. So it's been a parking lot for the nearby college. And it's been a parking lot really that's become important for the college because students can no longer really afford to live near the college. There's not enough student housing, and so, people are commuting long distances and parking their car on this reservoir that now the city is wanting to turn into a big project. Could add thousands of units here, and the neighbors are freaking out. The people who park there are freaking out that they're going to lose their parking. Parking is a big thing people freak out about. And the potential for thousands of units to go in there and for 25, maybe even 40% of it to be subsidized housing, is really amazing. But instead, we're debating about how many units they can shake off. It's been downscaled multiple times.
You touched upon the importance of a mass transit, and you mentioned how in New York, when you were living there, it made it a lot more feasible to live in a cheaper area and commute.
Mm-hmm.
And I know the Bay Area, they have a lot of, it's a little better than LA as far as transit goes, but has a lot of problems. BART has a reputation for being very slow. What are your thoughts on the topic in general and some of the proposals? I know there's this the SF Central subway, which is under construction, which would connect Union Square to North Beach and further south of there. But there's also been a proposed Gary subway that would connect the downtown area to the west side.
Yeah, right. There's a BART bond influx of cash for BART on this ballot this coming November, which everyone should vote for. But I would say that the big fundamental problem is that our tax base is not what it should be because of Prop 13, which was passed, which basically froze people's property taxes for a generation. So especially commercial properties, but everybody who owns land in San Francisco is super undertaxed. And all of the money that would have been coming from those property taxes and would be going to all the services that we so desperately need, including public transportation, is instead, sitting in people's assets, in their appreciating homes. So what Prop 13 does, do you guys know this already?
Yeah, I'm familiar with it. In some cases, you might have a middle-class person who's lived in a home for a long time, and obviously if their property taxes match the market value, they could lose their home. But are there also cases where you have, these wealthy landowners who, say, own a massive condo complex? Are they also benefiting from that?
Yeah, if we were to just rip the rug out from under people, it would be very jarring, sure. But what Prop 13 does is it freezes people's property taxes at the rate when they purchase their home. So even if a property is now worth, multiple millions of dollars, it's still being taxed at the, $70,000 that they purchased it at. Now, I understand that there are middle-income people who, would not be able to handle the property tax that they would then be levied, but they're sitting on often a multi-million dollar asset, right? So, my sympathy is there to some degree, but I think we have trouble thinking about the fact that there are middle-income people who are very wealthy, right? They are sitting on a very, very valuable asset. And the laws that we have constructed to reduce the amount of housing have benefited them, right? They have an asset that is appreciating directly in some large way because we have limited the supply of housing.
Krishan, do you have a question?
I guess, can you briefly describe what Prop C is and effects on the housing market? So,
Prop C that was just passed in June?
Yes, the 25% affordable housing mandate.
Yeah, that was proposed by Supervisor Jane Ham to what inclusionary zoning, the amount of that goes toward subsidized housing. So when you build a new project, you have to put either money or actually build subsidized housing for lowish income people. So it's about 55% of area median income. And we that from about 12% to 25%, because 25 is a nice round number and it seems like a nice thing to do. it wasn't really based on any economic feasibility studies. It wasn't based on whether or not this would have any, you know, net impact on how much housing was built. It was kind of, the chart was, developers are greedy, they're making a lot of money, I'm sure they can handle 25% that's, you know, inclusionary zoning. Then all the data came in and it was like, oh, actually 25% is way too high. That's from our city controller, who, you know, is the number crusher in chief. He said, no, 25% is going down the pipeline, is killing lots of projects. And he came out with the ideal number, 18%. So that was recently publicized in the Chronicle and other papers in San Francisco. So 18% is what he thinks the current magic number is. But it takes board supervisors now to adjust that number. And because it's now a political question, you know, nobody wants lower the percentage of affordable housing, right? Because that sounds like you're taking away from low-income people, even when it might be increasing the total number, right? But
right,
because
yeah.
we do percentages, it sounds like you're taking away from low-income people. So this is why a lot of us are like, this shouldn't be a political number to begin with, because politicians are never going to be able to do the right thing and vote to lower the inclusionary zoning rate. That's just politically, it sounds evil, even when it's the right thing to do.
I was going to say something obvious. Like, it sounds good in theory, but because of its impact, you know, the voters, you know, misjudge the policy. But
I'm just curious, because you have the property taxes are, if they're frozen, in San Francisco, they have like rent controls too. So if somebody's property taxes were going to go way up, but they couldn't raise the rent, I mean, I could see why a lot of places would be upset about that. You know, if you were, because if you can't raise the rent, then you can't offset the extra tax that you're going to be incurring.
Yeah, I mean, those are two policies that we're not going to fix anytime soon. You know, everyone knows that we need to fix rent control. Nobody is willing to take it on. You know, I think it's a big knot that we don't know how to untangle, because it's such an important stabilizing effect for so many people in San Francisco. And even though all of the big data sets say that, you know, the long-term it does some damage. You know, I don't think anybody knows how we're going to fix it.
Right, because I mean, I think rent control is a good thing, because they, you know, most people would never be able to absorb the kind of rent increases there would be without it. you know, even, like I said, even when I lived in Los Angeles, West Hollywood had rent controls, and my friend lived in the same apartment for like 10 years. And of course, he was making about the same amount of money, but you know, his rent was like, I think, maybe like $1,200 a month or something. But if he would have got out of that and rented an apartment like next door to his in the same complex, because the without the rent control, the new rent would have been like $3,000 a month, you know, where he was living. So, and with, of course, you know, people's wages aren't going up that fast, you know, if they're going up at all.
Yeah, I mean, this is a really hard thing, is that, like, the worse the housing crisis gets, the more important rent control becomes for the people who are in those rent-controlled units. You know, if we had a really well-functioning housing market, you know, if we had a really well-functioning housing market, getting evicted would not be that much of a tragedy, right? I mean, that's my goal, is to eventually get us to we can't stop eviction. There are going to be some cases where, you know, buildings catch on fire, the flood, the building's condemned, you know, somebody, whatever. Like, evictions are going to happen. And the question is, do we have a housing market that functions to the point where if you evict, you can find an equivalent place, and it's not such a tragedy for somebody's life. But the worse the housing crisis gets, the more painful each eviction becomes.
People who own condos tend to be well off, and obviously people own single-family homes especially. What is your thought on kind of the basic argument that a rental-based economy is a redistribution of wealth from the working class and middle class to the wealthy?
I don't find that super compelling. I mean, I think that right now our federal policy is artificially subsidizing, and our state policy is artificially subsidizing, home ownership. In, you know, I don't know. I mean, I'm an econ major, but I sort of remember there being a bunch of papers about, you know, in a super well functioning housing market, there shouldn't be a big difference between renting and owning. We're pretty far from that right now. You know, I mean, I don't want to own a home. I'm willing to pay a little bit extra probably to continue to rent and have flexibility in my life and not be saddled with a giant asset that, you know, I have to sort of plan the next 20 years of my life around. I think there are a lot of people who fall into that category. You know, there are a lot of people who do want to own homes. I think that right now we have chronically underbuilt, whether that's condos or apartments. And in a really well-functioning housing market, apartments should be able to become condos and then condos become apartments. You know, that shouldn't be such a big difference.
I saw that article you posted about the Sierra Club. What has been some of your reactions from a lot of environmental organizations, including the Sierra Club? Have they been sympathetic, or have the reactions been a mix?
The local Sierra Club hates us, but the national Sierra Club, I mean, this is true sort of local, not 100%, but the leadership of the local Sierra Club, you know, has been a lot of people who, I don't know, I mean, I sort of jokingly, but I refer to them as viewists. They're not really environmentalists. They're people who like to look at pretty things. They think that any kind of development is bad, whether that's, you know, housing or, you know, they hear the word development project, and those are boogie words, and they mean construction, and construction is bad for the environment. They aren't yet at the level where they realize that true environmentalism means infill development, it means reducing suburban sprawl, it means bringing people into dense urban environments where they have a lower impact on the overall environment and are greener. You know, they're a little bit more old school. Hopefully we can bring them into the new generation, but I think for a lot of these people it's going to be kicking and screaming.
And that's what's going on, is if you limit housing within urban areas, people are going to build a tract housing over like a farmland and open space in places like Livermore and Gilroy.
Yeah. I mean, yes. I don't have anything to add to that. Yes.
Well, I know there's an organization called the Green Belt Alliance, and they're big on conserving open space, and they put up these excellent maps about like a land at risk for suburban sprawl, but I get the impression from their website that they seem kind of very sympathetic to things like a new urbanism. Are you familiar with that organization?
Yeah, I am. I worry about where you draw the green belt, right? But I think it's a pretty good idea. But like Marin is a great example. You know, they rejected BART. And then they got to say, oh, we don't have enough transportation. How could we possibly house all those people? And so they got to say no twice. You know, I would say we need to eventually incorporate the entire Bay Area. We need Marin, Oakland, San Francisco, Palo Alto, all of these communities to think and act as one, have an integrated public transportation, and you know, do a lot of infill development in areas that don't want to think of themselves as part of the San Francisco metropolitan area. And so the belt is going to be wider than I think people want it to be. But that's just what needs to happen.
Are you saying as far as open space, there has to be, like, some sacrifices? Or are you sympathetic to people who say that, like, all wilderness should be preserved? Or do you think there should be a compromise? Like, is it feasible to increase housing simply by building infill?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up going to marshes with my dad and bird watching. So I love true wild open space. But I also know the difference between, like, you know, the vast areas between highways. Necessarily open. It's not, you know, truly wild when it's the, you know, 2 miles between two sub-developments. You know, those are spaces that we need to really think critically about and say, you know, if it's near a public transportation hub, you know, it may be green, but in order to reduce suburban sprawl, it needs to be thought of as part of the menu of options. You know, beautiful park, and especially well-used urban park. I'm very all for preserving. You know, I grew up with, you know, just a teeny little postage stamp back in front yard, and most of my, like, childhood playtime was in the nearby park. I'm a big lover of parks. Green space is really important. But green space, like, the way that people often use it is just as a sort of sledgehammer to oppose all infill development. I think a lot of people use it without a great deal of sincerity.
I was doing some kind of a research on Google Maps. I was looking over, like, the Bay Area suburbs, specifically of Dublin. And what I was kind of observing is that they were building track housing up into the hills. But then on the other hand, they had these massive patches of space in between that were not being utilized, and even like massive parking lots. So that's an example of a sprawl that's very poorly utilized.
Yeah, totally. I think it fits back into your micro housing questioning, right? Because the track housing is kind of a willful disregard for how young people are wanting to live these days. You know, more since the 90s, people have more and more opting into wanting to live in cities. Young people want to live in cities. Young people don't necessarily own cars at the rates they used to, and are looking for dense urban environments. They want to live near public transportation. They want to bike. Don't want to live in that kind of track housing. But kind of track housing is something that a lot of these are comfortable with because it looks like the housing that, you know, their, like, boomers wanted when they were that age, and it looks like the kind of thing that they are comfortable with, you know, that's the one place where they can allow more housing is in that kind of track housing. It's really hard to change the thinking, say, hey, we do not need parking, we need more housing to be built with no parking. People can just hop on the train and get to where they're going.
So would you say this issue is primarily generational, like millennials versus baby boomers, or is it more complex than that?
I think it's a big piece of it. Of course, more complex than that, because every social problem is more complex than that, but I think it is a big piece of it.
Chris Sean, do you want to comment?
Yes. Well, my first question would be, is there any city in the United States whose housing market do you think is something that San Francisco should follow? Because, for example, Manhattan has a lot of construction, but it's so very expensive because, in general, it's a very small place. Or Houston has a lot of construction, but a lot of it's also sprawl. So I'm just asking, is there any housing market you think in the United States is admirable?
Yeah, so two things about this. New York is getting worse on its zoning rather than better. You know, they're having a little bit of improvements here and there, but they don't have as much construction as you would think. Houston, I would agree, has done a lot of the sprawl thing. They don't really like to invest in as much public transportation as they should be.
Right.
Kansas City is not bad, but I would actually have to say international. Tokyo, the boogeyman, they dealt with a ballooning population extremely well. And that's because they make their use policy at a much larger level than we do. They make it almost at the countrywide level. Whereas we, and especially San Francisco is the biggest example of that. There's 100+ cities that make up the San Francisco Bay Area.
Right.
So that's 100+ different little municipalities deciding their own destiny.
How many people, ideally, do you think the Bay Area could accommodate? Do you think there is, an eventual cap where they'll run out of space, or do you think there could be, do you believe that there could be infinite growth?
Eventually we're going to Mars, so I'm not really worried about it. I don't know that there is an eventual cap. So long as people keep having babies, we're going to have to keep dealing with it. So we're going to have to continue to grow, whether that means that, maybe central San Francisco, we're going to eventually hit, a technological wall where we can't build taller and we can't build denser. And maybe we decide for historical reasons we really want to preserve a lot of beautiful old Victorians. That's fine. Make them into beautiful museums. I'm totally happy with that. But we're so far from that. And especially when you consider, the metropolitan area. That's 100 years from now, if then. And then on top of that, we can build a functional city if we build great high-speed rail and public transportation. Maybe San Francisco and LA start to operate as, sister cities.
Yeah, I was even reading about this with the high-speed rail, that there's projections that Fresno and Merced will turn into commuter hubs for the Silicon Valley. And obviously, ideally, you want to have people work and live in the same area, but I still think that would be a vast improvement over the current situation.
Yeah. I mean, and also if we had people, I think there's something, there's the tech shuttle buses are an interesting sort of way of looking at it. We have these big tech firms that are creating big job hubs in the South Bay, but all of their staff don't want to live in that kind of environment. They want to live in a city. They want to live in San Francisco because it's cooler, it's more interesting, there's great restaurants, it's dense, it's vibrant. If the South Bay looks like that, if Cupertino looks like San Francisco, if they densified and made themselves into a vibrant, competitive, wonderful city, then they would be having all of those people coming and wanting to spend money there. It's just it's just a problem of people not wanting to change.
What are your thoughts on the concept of like a vertical city? I'm sure you've seen those proposals where you see these cities that are like self-sufficient, where they have these like indoor gardens and people like work and shop and live and go to school in like the same building. Do you see that as like a viable solution or more like a fantasy?
I mean, I think it's cute. It's cute, but I, I think, you know, I can't imagine. I mean, I feel like it's like mall. Maybe it'll be trendy for a little while until everybody realizes that it's kind of hellish and, the malls in America all quietly die. I don't know. Maybe that'll be a trendy thing. I think the only way we'll know if that's something that people really want is if they allow people to build things like it, either people choose to live and things like that, or if people choose not to. This is a case where I don't think we can predict it. I think that's where we let the market run a bunch of experiments and see what people like.
I think one also solution that would sort of address a lot of the historic preservation concerns would be to build kind of like tall structures, but similar to kind of the style of a lot of the towers that were, you know, a lot of the towers you see like on like Nob Hill that were built in the 20s and 30s. That's a way to sort of increase housing, but still sort of preserve that certain charm.
Yeah, another one I've heard people throw out is blimps. you put housing on a bunch of blimps or boats. I don't know. I think that the people who are worst at predicting what people 100 years from now will think of as pretty is the current generation, right? We are terrible at predicting what people will find attractive 100 years from now. You know, everyone was so opposed to Sutro Tower. They thought it was the ugliest thing. You know, now I have 2 t-shirts that have Sutro Tower on it. I'm not so worried about the ugliness factor. I think that people will build things that they like.
Yeah, I mean, Robert touched on it a little bit earlier, but what I thought was kind of interesting and almost sort of dystopian is the these companies like Facebook are starting to build, housing, like, you know, nearby or on site, like for their employees. And on the one hand, it's kind of interesting because, if you work there, you get to live in these places and so forth. On the other hand, it's kind of disturbing because it's, you know, people are kind of slaves to their job anyways. Like, imagine if, like, you know, you work at Yelp, but, like, they're also your landlord, and, like, telling you, like, how much water you can use and, like, what you can wear around. I mean, it's almost kind of like, I think a lot of these, some of these more, like, egomaniac CEOs in Silicon Valley, they have this idea that they're going to, you know, create their own, all-encompassing, like, kind of almost micro city states or whatever. But, you know, if you've ever worked at some of these, I've definitely worked at some of these social media, giant companies, and, you know, the people who work there that are like in, on the low end or in sales or whatever, like they totally hate the place. Like I think these CEOs are sometimes like delusional about how much people actually love their company that they work there, you know?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people love their company because the company spends a lot of time, like, right now courting employees and buying them snacks. The building the housing stuff is purely because nobody is building housing, you know, around these. The local governments have kept housing from being built. And so the tech companies are freaking out and saying, we need to house our workers, and we need this problem to be solved. And there is a dual problem. They want to hire really skilled people, and really skilled people want to live in, you know, the U.S. 10 cities. They don't want to live. Yeah, I've heard people say, like, oh, you know, everybody should just move these jobs to, you know, some other random city, you know, insert whatever city, Atlanta or whatever. And, you know, Atlanta's great, sure, but, you know, these highly educated people want to live in San Francisco, you know, maybe New York, maybe Portland's also pretty cool. If we don't build the housing that is necessary, we're stifling the entire U.S. economy.
Yeah, well, I was just going to say, I think that also another factor, though, with these companies is that that they want to underpay people, because a lot of the, like, I live in Phoenix, and a lot of these Silicon Valley companies, they have offices here as well. You know, there's probably about, like 30 or 4 of them. Yeah, Yelp, Reputation.com, and there's tons of them that have offices here where they hire tons of people. And I always think it's amazing, like, when I read these these reviews on, like, Glassdoor and whatnot, that in San Francisco, that, you know, they're not paying these people much more than what they get paid here, despite the fact that it costs much less to live here. So it's almost like they want to have this on-site housing out there so they can, you know, avoid paying, you know, these people in sales or whatnot that are, you know, they're paying them like a salary of like 30 or 35 grand a year, as opposed to like the 30 grand or something that they get here at entry level. And I can't even imagine, you know, trying to live in San Francisco on that kind of money.
Yeah, that's, you know, a lot of my friends from help, that's something they're struggling with. I would also say that, like, they're making what should be perfectly good money, and it's only not good money because so much of it is being siphoned off into rent. And that's something that we've legislated. This is a problem of our own making. And yes, we can sort of, you know, say that all the tech companies should be paying their employees more money. I mean, everybody should be paying all employees probably more money. You know, we need stronger unions. We need to see, you know, wages stagnate. But on top of that, we're seeing a huge amount of that money get siphoned off to rent because there's not enough competition between landlords, right? The more housing you build, the more competition between landlords there is, the more other options people have to find, you know, another apartment that's cheaper and that may be better suited for them.
I know with the whole sort of political situation, obviously the Bay Area is most people vote Democrat, and Republicans are pretty much politically irrelevant. But just because everyone's a Democrat or a liberal or whatever doesn't mean that they're all going to agree. The main political conflict in the Bay Area is pretty much the housing issue is one of the primary issue. So you basically, from my observation, you have three groups. You have a group by your organization. Then you have a lot of wealthy NIMBYs. Then you also have groups, like there are some progressive groups that are concerned about, like, techies gentrifying the Mission District. So within self-identified progressives, you have all these internal political conflicts over these different issues, but housing seems to be the big one.
Yeah, I mean, so it's complicated. So right now it kind of breaks down into self-identified progressives and self-identified moderates, even though I would say those two titles aren't quite accurate. But the progressive coalition is made up of... So, like, right now we've made it into a zero-sum game, right? It's kind of one in, one out. So if you have a wealthy person who wants to move into the Bay Area, they are probably taking somebody's apartment. You know, I mean, that's not the way that anybody likes to think about it, but that's what happens when you have a shortage. So the visceral experience of low-income people is it's very easy to hate another worker, a higher income worker who's coming in and taking over their neighborhood, right? That emotionally makes a lot of sense to hate on the tech worker. It's harder to say, actually, you should be hating this abstract shortage of housing. And so people who are low income activists sometimes end up being anti-tech, anti the booming economy, rather than being pro increasing housing. On top of that, you have wealthy homeowners who have no incentive to want to see more housing be built. And they go in for the neighborhood character argument. We need to preserve neighborhood character. So for low-income activists, that means trying to keep the current residents in place. And for high wealthy people who are part of that coalition, that means keeping their neighborhood looking the same. And so that's what it ends up meaning. So you have all these progressives who are arguing for conservation, conservative policies on housing. And then you have the milquetoast moderates. So the moderates are this coalition of some sort of wealthier homeowner people, but who in general sort of have a predisposition towards liking the idea of business. So you have the business interest, and that ends up being mass employers in the area who don't like that so much of the wages is being siphoned off into housing, that they have to pay their workers so much more in the Bay Area. So big business is on the side of grow housing, in general, not across the board, but in general. And then you have some people who are for housing for the people who work in it, who live in it. And then you've got sort of labor mostly on the pro-housing, but kind of split and not really sure what it's doing. It's kind of messy.
With a lot of these issues, do you see it like there's a sort of concept of NIMBYism versus you call yourself a YIMBY, which is like the opposite. Do you think it's kind of an all or nothing, or do you think people can find a common ground and find compromises about on a specific project? Maybe someone dislikes aspects of a project, but they can look at each project on a case by case basis or make adjustments. Or do you think there can be like a compromise?
I think the compromise needs to take place not on a case by case basis, but on the rules that we set for zoning and other regulations at a bigger level. If we negotiate on a case-by-case basis, it slows the pipeline way down, and it really sort of, it's difficult to get the two sides of the table to be actually representative of real interests, right? Because on a case-by-case basis, the people who live nearby and are willing to spend, 10 hours a week dealing with all the hearings and paperwork, trying to get somebody who just sort of generally thinks we need more housing to devote that kind of time and energy, only crazy people like me do that, right? So if we keep doing a case-by-case basis, we're going to continue to see massive slowdowns in our housing production. I think that there is a negotiation is totally possible. I think people come down in the middle, but I think that right now we hear a lot of fake arguments against housing. You hear a lot of people say, oh, I'm for density, but, and then they say what they really think. I'm for affordable housing, but think about all these other considerations. I listen to a lot of people say, oh, yeah, of course we have these big concepts that we need, but nobody actually likes to see the housing that fulfills those needs go into their backyard. So where we negotiate needs to be pushed a lot further.
I think that's pretty much more or less the current system, right? Like they hold zoning hearings, and then projects are downzoned based on the objections, and stuff gets built, but it's a lot less than what the developers might have intended. But can I just say something that might be a little unrelated to the current discussion? But this is a general comment. Especially as millennials and older people, like in the libertarian movement, which is, I guess, what I've come from, because I've just been related to all those people. A lot of the older people never really discussed land use issues. Like in the 80s, for example, so the big issue among the right was, taxes. Those were cut. And then in the 90s, it was welfare reform, and that was passed. But there's not a lot more you can do with taxes or with welfare. Those systems have basically been, the right has had. That's been, a battle fought, and I guess you could say we won. So the issue with a lot of young libertarians and conservatives, I guess people on the right, is, you know, what issue will make us relevant again? You know, like, how can we possibly, like, you know, remain in contact with the public, you know, instead of just being seen as people who just show for the wealthy? And I think zoning might be that very issue, because I see a lot of young libertarians getting involved in this kind of stuff, and they should be, because unlike tax cuts or welfare, you know, because like with tax cuts, like the beneficiaries are really wealthy people. Or if you're talking about welfare, you know, the people who lose from that sort of thing are the poor people. But on this issue, it seems like we're allies with the working class and against, you know, wealthy NIMBY homeowners. And I know you guys might not all come from that background, but that's just a comment I want to make. I'm sorry.
No, I think it's really funny because, like, the union movement is such a weird, like, I've never been part of such a thing that is so weird politically. Like, because I'm super progressive. I believe in a lot of government intervention in most markets. What's that?
I said boo, but whatever. Yeah.
I know, right? I know, right?
So would you? So you'd welcome someone with like a libertarian, or someone showed up in a Trump hat?
I don't know about Trump, because like Trump's opinions are just a gobbledygook. But
he has built a lot of the skyscrapers.
Right. Yeah. I would say, no comment on that. I think he's also done a lot of damage. But in any case, the YIM movement is a third hybrid between super progressive people and libertarian people. It is a movement mostly renters. You know, some allied homeowners and whatnot. It's mostly a generational. It's a lot of millennials who feel totally priced out and cut out of the housing market in any real way. It's super progressive people plus libertarians. And I'm still getting used to that.
No, but just about, I know this is an uncomfortable subject, but just about Trump, I think the reason he became popular, I think, in the first place was because it was perceived that the old Republican Party was very much against, you know, deindustrialized, you know, middle America white workers, you know, like Romney's 47% remark, which is insensitive. And, you know, even for all this rhetoric he says that is very bigoted and offensive, he also says a lot of stuff, he gives lip service at least, you know, oh, you know, these deindustrialized, you know, workers, you know, they're really suffering, you know, they're in a lot of pain. So I think the thing is, the YIMBY movement, it's just like what Trump is doing. You know, we're at least talking about something that's relevant to the poor. You know, we're talking about housing affordability. And I think that's why it might take a foothold on the right, because instead of these old ideas that I discussed that mainly benefit rich people, you know, we're now talking about stuff that's relevant to everybody's daily life. So that's what I'm saying. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I mean, I have a lot of, so I went to school in upstate New York, and I've got friends in Maine, and some people sort of scattered around the sort of post-industrial city in New England, and they really struggle. You know, it's a hard conversation to sort of realize that people who I you know, played with as kids, their economic opportunity is just narrowing and narrowing. You know,
exactly.
That I'm worried that they're going to end up as like heroin addicts out in the boonies. And, you know, of course I don't say that, but, you know, you can just see the level of opportunity in their lives dwindling. And
absolutely.
Many of these people, if they had had the opportunity, you know, if it had been feasible to move to a city at age 18 or 19 or 20, if they felt like they could have landed there, been able to afford the rent as they figured their shit out for a couple months, you know, they listen to the same music I listen to. They, you know, they read Reddit. You know, they're on the internet and they are smart, capable people, and yet they're stuck in these cities where there's just not a lot of opportunity for them. And that's something that really breaks my heart, and, you know, is also really motivating for me to say, like, every everything I can do to add more housing in the Bay Area. You know, it is a national issue.
Absolutely.
It is really about building opportunity for people around the country.
I just wanted to say that it's interesting. It's almost not really a left-right issue, because you actually see a lot of the far left and the right actually kind of team up to prevent these kinds of developments for different reasons. It kind of, like was mentioned before, you have a segment like on the Sierra Club and some of these groups that just oppose any kind of building of anything, basically. And then you also have people on the right that just don't want their property values to go down on their investments and so forth, or they don't want to they don't want to bring in more people to a certain area. It's kind of like when you build apartments somewhere, like that lots of times that creates problems in the neighborhood and so forth. So they both oppose these things for different reasons. And I think that also there is something about there being less opportunity. It also has to do, I think, with the transient nature of these companies. When my dad was a machinist, just out of high school, age 18, he, got a job in a factory making like, 30 or 40 grand a year. And that was in like the early 1970s. You could buy like a brand new car for like a couple thousand dollars or something. So, that was really a big deal. Whereas, he worked there probably for 20 or 30 years before the company went under. He was able to get a different job. But a lot of the newer companies, these tech companies, they get funding or something, and they're around for like maybe like 2 years. If they run out of funding, they get bought by somebody else, people get laid off. So to move to live in a big city, like, you've always got to be on top of your game, because you could be the social media company, or if that's the current fad, it can go out of business pretty quick when their scheme isn't profitable. And so you may find you're looking for a new job every 1 to 2 years, and in a situation where these rents are super expensive, you can't really afford to be out on your ass without a job at one of these places for very long. So I think that does have kind of a draining effect on some of these millennials, especially, that are having to change jobs every 6 months or 2 years or something. When the new company comes to town, they offer all these benefits and everything, and then they they lose funding, their company's not profitable, their wacky idea didn't work out, and suddenly the you're out of a job.
Yeah, and being in a city, if you're needing to find a new job every 2 years or so or less, being in a city is critical to that, because being able to find the next thing is large geographic. We haven't all, plugged into the hive mind quite yet. People need to be in a job-dense area in order to deal with the fact that, everybody's needing to become more nimble, and sort of we're all freelancers these days. That requires being in a city.
We are at the end of the show. Laura, is there anything else you would like to add about these general topics about the housing crisis?
I think I just want to say right now we are in a situation where millennials have not really been voting, and millennials don't vote in local elections. They don't do all the down-ballot voting. They don't learn about all of the policies that are actually affecting their day-to-day lives. It's very easy to pay attention to sort of the national conversation, but we've made it really difficult to pay attention to the hyper-local things that really impact all of the lives. I think I want to encourage everybody wherever you are to get more involved in local politics, because that's going to have the most impact. And it's also really fun. I don't want to speak poorly about local politics, but I'm about to. The bar is really low, right? Like, you can, like, go volunteer on a campaign for, like, 2 months, and suddenly you've got 100 friends. Everybody's inviting you to everything. They're, like, so happy because you're just a competent person who showed up and is helping out. So if you're a lonely millennial, I highly recommend getting involved in local politics.
Laura Foote Clark, it's been an excellent show. Thanks for being on.
Thanks so much for having me.